We'll introduce our speakers for today's Online Communist Forum, which is organized on a weekly basis by Communist Party of Great Britain and Labour Party Marxists. So this week I'm very pleased to say that we have two very important people in terms of two people who've brought a great deal of information to us about the communist women's movement, and something that badly needed to happen to inform our movements and those coming into our movement now about the communist women's movement and its actions, its ideas, and the obstacles, etc., that it faced. So that's, I believe that your work has been extremely important. The book, which has been out for some time and is available to buy from Haymarket, is a communist women's movement from 1920 to 1922. Its first 2 years, its proceedings from its conferences of the first 2 years, and various other reports of work in the years after. So Mike Tabor, comrades will already know because he's been to these forums and given talks before on the Second International in particular, but also he's written a number of books on various individuals connected with the movement. Daria Durakovina, it's her first time coming along to one of our forums, and I'm very pleased that she's here. I've had the pleasure of working with you both and attending a conference with Daria in Glasgow last year to discuss the book. And so both of you have been involved in researching and editing this book, but also I know, Daria, you've also been involved in studying the youth movement of the Communist International also, and various other projects. So without any further ado, I'd like to ask you to speak and to give your introduction, and I'd ask Mike if you could please speak first. I think that's okay with you, Daria, and I believe
Yes.
you're going to address the issues in the preface to your book. Anyway, I'll let you speak. Okay, half an hour each. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Anne. I'm glad to be back at the Online Communist Forum. Every time I've spoken here, I've found the discussions to be interesting, well-informed, and thought-provoking. Some of you may remember that I spoke here about this topic last year, so I'll try not to simply repeat what I said then. What I want to talk about today is how the book on the Communist Women's Movement that Daria and I have edited adds to our knowledge and appreciation of the Comintern, of communist leadership, as well as the importance of the Communist Women's Movement and its legacy. In doing so, I'll be referring to a number of debates and discussions found in the pages of the book. I'll start with what the book tells us about the Comintern's auxiliary organizations. Whenever I speak about the Communist International, I always try to describe it not just as a worldwide organization, but as a living movement with all the complexities and contradictions that every social movement has. In many ways, this point is best illustrated by the auxiliary organizations. These include the Communist Women's Movement, the Communist Youth International, the Red International of Labor Unions, Red Aid, Red Sports, the Peasants International, the Anti-Imperialist League, organizations of veterans, children, and others. The dictionary definition of auxiliary refers to something that renders assistance, that provides help. It implies something that's secondary, of lesser importance. When it comes to the communist movement, that may indeed be true in terms of overall policy and direction, but it's definitely not true when it comes to influence and reach. Because when it comes to the influence of communism in the years after 1919, many more people were reached by these auxiliary organizations than by the communist parties alone. The book edited by Daria and me on the CWM is the first of several books in the Comintern publishing series focusing on the auxiliary organizations. The next book, which should come out in hardback later this year, will be on the founding Congress of the Red International of Labor Unions, the Profintern. And we're now at work preparing a volume devoted to the Communist Youth International. In the Comintern's early years, each of the auxiliary organizations had a considerable amount of independent initiative and autonomy, even the ones that were formally part of the Comintern, such as the Communist Women's Movement. Other auxiliaries were formally independent, like the Profintern, although there were ties of various sorts with the Comintern's executive committee. Each of these organizations had its own history and character. For example, the Communist Women's Movement and Communist Youth International both came directly out of the Second International. Most other auxiliaries had no such background. However, they all arose in their own unique way. All the auxiliary organizations also had their own leaderships. And of these, the CWM had the strongest leading team by far. And I'm not just referring to its central leaders, Clara Zetkin, Alexandra Kollontai, and Anessa Armand, but there were also a whole host of capable secondary leaders within the different national parties. And the book will help introduce readers to these remarkable women. One thing our new book challenges is the standard narrative that you'll find about how the Comintern auxiliaries were all totally Moscow dominated and controlled. In the CWM, in fact, many, if not most, of the important initiatives came from parties other than the Russian. Take International Women's Day, for example. As probably everyone here knows, this day, which we've just celebrated, originated at the 1910 Copenhagen Conference of the Socialist Women's Movement. But in its early years, International Women's Day was held on different days in early March, often on a Sunday. As an event, the day had receded somewhat during the war and was only revived to a significant extent by the Communist Women's Movement. But this was still done on a country-by-country basis, and it was held on different days in different countries. When International Women's Day came up for discussion at the second conference of the CWM in 1921, however, there was a proposal made by the Bulgarian delegation to hold the event on the same day everywhere. And as part of this motion, the Bulgarian Communist Women proposed that March 8th be declared International Women's Day universally, in order to commemorate the demonstration by Russian women in Petrograd in 1917, which kicked off the revolution that wound up overthrowing Tsarism. Surely this fact, which some of you may have noticed on page 394 of our book, is an important milestone in the history of International Women's Day, one that few people today know about. Another initiative that didn't originate in Russia was the main document of the Communist Women's Movement. I'm referring to the guidelines of the Communist Women's Movement, the single most important theoretical and political document coming out of the CWM, which you can find in the book. This document was drafted by Zetkin and then rewritten by Anessa Armand and the Russian delegation. It then went back to Zetkin, who revised it considerably. That fact and the volume as a whole highlights the leadership role of Zetkin and reinforces our image of her as an outstanding political leader, not just of the CWM, but of the communist movement as a whole. I myself had only realized this fact fully from seeing how Zetkin participated in the debate at the Third Comintern Congress, where she stood up to widespread abuse to help lead the successful political battle there, as well as from the report Zetkin gave on fascism at the Executive Committee plenum in 1923, which I believe was the first clear analysis of what was then a brand new phenomenon. But the book on the CWM gives a whole new dimension of her leadership capabilities. Here, I'd also like to call attention to the efforts by Ben Lewis to translate many of Zetkin's early articles in the Socialist Women's Movement, which adds to our appreciation of her role. Zetkin was the living link between the Communist Women's Movement and the International Socialist Women's Movement that had been affiliated to the Second International. Through the new book, one can clearly see the lines of continuity between the earlier body and the CWM. This was actually the subject of a debate at the first CWN conference in 1920. The Russian delegation had presented a draft thesis, which among other things rejected the entire legacy of the Second International in relation to women. But a number of delegates from Germany and elsewhere objected to this view, pointing to the role of Zetkin in the earlier body. As a result of these objections, this criticism was deleted from the draft. Something else that shows this connection between the pre-war International Socialist Women's Movement and the Communist Women's Movement is Zetkin's report on political rights for women, given to the second CWM conference in 1921, much of which focused on the question of women's suffrage. I was struck by the similarities of this report to Zetkin's report on women's suffrage given to the 1907 Congress of the Second International. Excerpts from that earlier report can be found in my book of Second International Debates. Zetkin's report to the 1921 conference on the fight for women's equality tied the denial of women's rights to capitalist rule. As such, she spoke of the revolutionary dynamics of the fight for women's emancipation and its integral relation to the working class struggle as a whole against capitalism. From this analysis, Zetkin called for communists to participate in fact, to throw themselves into this fight. While participating in it, she insisted, communists always put forward a working class perspective independent from bourgeois women's rights organizations. At the same time, however, Zetkin stressed that communists are always willing to work with other forces in common struggle without subordinating themselves to such forces. Zetkin's report was criticized by a number of delegates at the CWN conference. Most of those of these attacks came from an ultra-left direction, accusing her of reformism and parliamentarism and of wanting to mix banners with other class forces. And I think you'll find that Zetkin defended her views quite effectively. The question of the CWM's class orientation came up in a different way at the same conference. A very interesting exchange took place there between Zetkin and Kollontai on the role of housewives and other layers of women. Kollontai had given a report on forms and methods of work that called for centering all efforts among working women in the factories. In the discussion, Zetkin, while agreeing with Kollontai that working women must be the foundation of the movement, nevertheless thought that Kollontai had been a little too mechanical and schematic about it. Zetkin spoke of how other social layers, proletarian housewives, peasant women, and so-called intellectual women, meaning teachers, nurses, civil servants, and so forth, would play a necessary role in the revolutionary struggle and must not be ignored. The difference here was primarily over nuance and emphasis, since Zetkin and Kollontai agreed with each other on essentials, but it reflected a constant theme that Zetkin referred to all her life on the need for allies. Even though she believed that working women are the most oppressed and need to be the foundation of the struggle for women's emancipation, she also recognized that women's oppression affects all social layers to some extent, which meant that individuals and forces from these layers could either be won to the struggle, at least partially, or else be neutralized, that is, prevented from becoming open enemies. The working class, Zetkin always insisted, required allies without whom it could not win. One discussion that came up again and again at the second conference, as those who have read the book will know, involved complaints and criticisms of sexist attitudes of men within the communist movement and its leadership, as well as these men's underestimation of the CWM's work and of communist women in general. Such sexist attitudes reflected a longstanding weakness of the early Marxist movement in relation to what used to be called the woman question. That on the level of programs, socialists had always supported with equal rights for women and women's emancipation, going back to Babel and Engels. But alongside that proud history, there was a tendency of many socialists to stand aside from concrete fights for women's rights, to see the issue as a diversion from the working class struggle, and to deprioritize the issue, seeing it as of lesser importance than other ones. As I mentioned, criticism of sexist attitudes by communist men was widespread at the second CWM conference, including from leading CWM cadres. This is definitely something readers will find to be of interest. But interestingly enough, these criticisms were not voiced by Zetkin. While she obviously recognized the problem, she focused instead on the political line that would make it possible to overcome these weaknesses. At the same time, she supported special steps to develop women cadres and leaders, what today we might call affirmative action measures. What's of greatest interest, in my opinion, were not the complaints in and of themselves, but rather the recognition of the political nature of this problem within the movement. That was something new, along with the efforts to try and solve it. In fact, as can be seen in the book, between 1920 and 1922, enormous progress was made in beginning to overcome this historic problem. That's what should be stressed, I think. Turning to another subject, there was discussion at the first and second CWM conferences on the work in Soviet Russia around women's emancipation. This work centered on several things. First, drawing women in their masses into the workforce and into social life in general through education and other means. This was seen both as a necessity for the new revolutionary order as well as for the women themselves. And not just into the workforce, but into politics, getting them involved in mass organizations and the Soviets. Readers will encounter a number of initiatives taken in early Soviet Russia to facilitate this task, such as the delegate system, which I won't go into here. Secondly, granting women full political equality and establishing legal rights in every area, along with other legal measures such as legalization of abortion, complete freedom of divorce, ending the distinction between legitimate and illegitimate children, and so forth. And thirdly, efforts were made to free women from being slaves to the drudgery of housework through creation of maternal and childcare centers, communal kitchens, laundries, and so forth. Such a situation would begin to create new family relationships and a new type of family. The family as it presently exists cannot simply be abolished as it's sometimes put forward today. It has to be replaced with something. And these steps in early Soviet Russia were in fact the first steps in doing exactly that. A key role in all this was the Soviet CP's women's department, Genotel, headed first by Inessa Armand and then after she died by Kollontai. Here I'll simply refer to Anne's dissertation to her upcoming book on this department. Material in this new volume, however, will significantly add to the overall picture. There are some truly fascinating and inspiring parts of the book referring to work in Soviet Russia among women in Soviet Central Asia. And that work also dovetailed with and contributed to discussion at CWN conferences on what was then called the Eastern Question. That is the situation of women in colonial and semi-colonial countries, primarily in the near and far east of Asia. I won't go into that here, except to say that this was a central priority for Kollontai above all, as well as for Genotel as a whole. The last thing I'll speak of is why this book has special resonance today. For one thing, virtually all of these issues and all of the struggles that are taken up in the book are still the scene of struggle today in one form or another, whether it's abortion, reproductive rights, child care, equal pay for equal work, and so on. And today we see clearly how the fight for women's emancipation increasingly takes on an international character. Witness the worldwide impact of the victories for abortion rights in Ireland, Mexico, and Argentina, not to mention of the battles in places where this right has been reversed, either fully or partially, as in Poland and the United States. The idea of a worldwide movement of women and for women's rights will undoubtedly spark the imagination of many. So for these and other reasons, I believe that the perspective of the communist women's movement in its early years still offers valuable insights for today. To highlight three elements of this perspective, which I think have particular importance at present. First, its view on the revolutionary dynamics of the women's emancipation struggle. That is, the struggle for women's liberation in itself has a deeply revolutionary thrust, and it's inextricably tied to the overall working class struggle. Communists thus have a duty to participate in this fight and help lead it along proletarian lines. Second, its view that women's oppression is rooted in capitalism and class society. Consequently, women's liberation is ultimately tied to the elimination of this exploitative system and to the establishment of socialism. And third, its view that working class women have the biggest stake in the fight for women's emancipation and should be its base. At the same time, as I indicated earlier, that while working class women will be the foundation of the struggle, the oppression of women nevertheless affects women in all social layers to one degree or another. The movement therefore needs to find avenues of approach to all potential allies and seek to involve them in the fight to the extent possible. Anyway, it's my hope that readers will find this book to be both an inspiration as well as a source of lessons to think about and to learn from. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. That was great. So I'm going to pass it over to Daria now to give your presentation, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, for having us here. Thanks, Mike, for a great start of this this discussion. In what I'm going to say, I will perhaps repeat some of the things that Mike has mentioned, but I think it doesn't hurt. These are important things, so it's worth repeating them once again, and I will probably insist on some other points. I think I will use my time to speak about a little bit about how the Communist Women's Movement was created, what was its program and activities in the early 20s, in Lenin's time, as Mike has mentioned. And I will then speak about the contents of the book in a bit more detail to allow the readers to have a glimpse of the rich documentary material that the book contains. First of all, the Communist Women's Movement was founded in 1920, right? Just 1 year after the Communist International, the Comintern, was created in 1919. The Communist Women's Movement was not an official name, but this was the name used by communist revolutionary women to speak about themselves. And as Mike has already pointed out, the program of the movement for women's emancipation was quite progressive and ahead of its time, and included emancipation of women. First of all, it insisted on the link between women's emancipation and the revolutionary transformation of societies. It called for total equality of rights of men and women in law and practice, full integration of women into political, economic, and social life. It called for social measures to ease the burden of housework and childcare for women, free education and medical care for women, as well as social aid for pregnant women and mothers. I will now say a few words about the studies that exist on this movement today. Although a rich body of literature has studied women, gender, and communism, the works on the communist women's movements, institutions, and networks that use a transnational perspective to study them remain limited. Scholars of Soviet history have made important contributions on the work of the women's department of the Russian Communist Party, the Zhenodel, that Mike has mentioned as well, and on some outstanding women's leaders. A few works have discussed interwar communist women's efforts in separate countries, mostly in Europe. Fewer contributions have engaged with the history of the movement in a transnational perspective. At the same time, many authoritative Western scholars have tended to dismiss communist, party-aligned, and affiliated women's organizations and communist, and especially Soviet, policies towards women. And the same dismissive attitude is largely present in scholarly contributions on socialist/communist women's rights activism. Liberal feminists of Cold War era and some more recent commentators have highlighted that communist or socialist women's movements after World War II mobilized their memberships primarily to serve party goals rather than mobilize the party to serve women. Some socialists, feminists in turn, have criticized Marxism's inability to sufficiently analyze the centrality of the gender division of labor in all spheres, including crucially the family, and the lack of concern with sexuality and reproduction issues or violence towards women. So in light of these historiographical trends, and given that the communist women's movement remains largely unknown and is usually excluded from the traditional scholarly narrative of the waves of feminism, the book seeks to give the readers a first-hand experience with ideas, debates, and work of the movement. And in this sense, the book challenges the still persisting vision of feminism as a movement led by upper and middle class, liberal, and predominantly white Western women. Now let me say a few words about how the movement actually functioned. On the international level, the work was coordinated by the International Women's Secretariat, which was founded first in Moscow, then in Berlin, then moved back to Moscow. It existed between November 1920 and 1935. And Clara Zetkin was the head of the secretariat. It is important to point out here the relative independence of the movement, of the women's movement, from the Comintern central apparatus in the early 20s. These women, communist women, would hold international conferences in Moscow annually to discuss general strategy. And they would also have, in this early period, biannual meetings in Berlin of the so-called women's correspondents. And in the book, we have reports of these smaller conferences where women would actually exchange their experience on the ground in different countries. The Communist Women's Movement also created a secretariat for the Near East to coordinate work in West Asia and Turkey. And finally, they also had their own international monthly magazine called Die Kommunistische Frauen Internationale, the Communist Women's International, which was published between 1920 and 1925, where a lot of articles describing the activities in different countries were published. In its early years, but also later, but the book focuses on the early years, the movement led internationally coordinated campaigns. Mike has mentioned a few of them, so I will just very quickly enumerate them here. So they revived the International Women's Day, and indeed, as Mike has pointed out, it was the Communist Women's Initiative to celebrate it on one fixed date, the 8th of March. And that's when we celebrate it today. Another campaign was obviously the campaign for equal pay for equal work and against discriminatory layoffs of women. Something that we would call affirmative action today was the campaign to promote women to leadership positions in communist parties, but also trade unions. They campaigned also for the transformation of housework into social industry through the creation of public amenities such as canteens, laundries, childcare facilities that would ease the burden of housework and childcare on women. Another very important and quite successful, efficient campaign was the relief to Soviet Russia, ruined by World War I and Civil War. Women engaged very actively in that. They also led campaigns focused on anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist fight. And finally, I would like to mention another campaign, which is still of relevance today, and that was the campaign for reproductive rights with quite ahead of its time slogans, such as "Your body belongs to you." I have seen exactly the same slogans a few days in Geneva at the celebrations of the 8th of March. So on the one hand, campaign for reproductive rights, but also campaigns for the social measures for mothers and children, to support mothers and children. All right, so now let me go directly to the book and say a few words about the contents. So what do we have there in the book? The book opens with Mike's preface and my introduction, and then we have Lenin's speech, which he delivered at a Moscow City Conference of Working Women in September 1919, where Lenin spoke of the tasks of the working women's movement in the Soviet Russia. And in this speech, Lenin actually established a direct link between capitalism and gender inequality. Let me quote here. "Wherever there is capitalism, wherever there is private property in land and factories, wherever the power of capital is preserved," he argued, "the men retain their privileges." Moreover, Lenin contended, Lenin pointed out that women faced double or triple slavery, as all housework was left to them. So after the revolution, after the October Revolution 1917 in Russia, Lenin, in collaboration with communist revolutionary women in Russia, Alexandra Kollontai, Nessa Arman, Nadezhda Krupskaya, among many others, promoted the liberation of women in the new Soviet state, in the family, at work, and in the political sphere. And he also encouraged the foundation in 1920 of the International Communist Women's Movement. Mike nicely points out in his preface, he has quotes by Lenin when he exchanges on this topic with Zetkin, saying that basically, the international communist movement cannot survive without the participation of communist women. So that's the first item of the book. Then we have the proceedings of the first conference, which was held in Moscow in the summer 1920. So at this conference, more than 50 delegates representing 19 countries gathered to discuss women's issues in the framework of the Second Congress of the Comintern and to found the International Communist Women's Movement. So this was a founding conference, right? So it was smaller compared to the second one, as the times were still difficult, right? Not many delegates could make it, but they did send their reports, right, which were also read out at the conference. Most importantly, the first conference set up a commission to write the guidelines for the communist women's movement, which Clara Zetkin drafted. So these guidelines laid out general theoretical principles. I have already mentioned most of them. So the guidelines once again linked the oppression of women to the existence of the capitalist system and the necessity for women to join the revolutionary struggle to obtain true emancipation. Then, of course, all the things such as equal rights and full equality in political, social, economic spheres, including the voting right, access to education, medical care, support to mothers and children, were also mentioned in those guidelines. The guidelines also defined the more specific tasks of the communist women's movement for socialist, capitalist, or pre-capitalist countries. Let me now say a few words about the third part of the book, which is the proceedings of the second conference of communist women held in June 1921 in Moscow. So this is, in a way, a central piece of the book. And Mike has spoken quite a bit about the important debates that actually took place during this second conference, which had more delegates from more countries. It was also slightly longer. So these proceedings come from the Comintern archives and were never published before in any language. This debate, so this conference, these proceedings are truly vibrant, full of lively, passionate debates on a number of questions of principle. Mike has already mentioned debate on parliamentarism and participation in elections, but also on collaboration with non-proletarian women's rights fighters. There was also a debate between the adherents and opponents of the so-called revolutionary offensive theory, right, with attacks on Zetkin. The place of non-proletarian women within the movement, right, which is basically the question of the base of the movement, was discussed quite a lot, and the place of intelligentsia, peasant women, housewives, was debated. So the opinions differed, right, oftentimes, but at the same time, at the end, the delegates managed to harmonize their opinions and differences and work out a coherent plan of action and work together as a team committed to decisions, resolutions adopted by all. So there were a few important resolutions that were passed at this second conference. One of them was a resolution that, well, basically, at the moment in summer 1921, not all countries had women's sections within their communist parties. So one of the resolutions insisted on the importance of establishing women's sections where they did not yet exist, and urged parties, right, parties leadership to support women while at the same time granting them certain independence of methods of work. Another resolution insisted on the importance of reaching out to the broad non-communist masses of women. And this kind of united front perspective was quite important at the time for the Comintern in general, but also for communist women. Finally, another resolution created the correspondence conferences, right? Those biannual meetings that would be held in Berlin every 6 months or so. And indeed, the next item of the book is reports on two of such conferences held in January and October 22. These reports come from Kommunistische Fraueninternationale magazine. There are also resolutions adopted at these correspondence conferences that we have in the book. So at the first conference, delegates from Russia, Germany, UK, France, Sweden, Romania, Switzerland, Denmark, and more, and Denmark got together, and other countries have sent their reports. The questions discussed there were rather practical. One of them was the relief to Soviet Russia. Another one was the revival of the International Women's Day, and a specific date, indeed, the 8th of March, was fixed. The second correspondence conference was even more representative, with delegates from all European countries, except Great Britain, and also delegates from the Near and Far East. And the book also has a report on the Conference of the Women of the East, organized by this secretariat for the Near East, right, established in 1921, which was held in Tiflis, today's Tbilisi, in Georgia, in December 21. So at this conference, delegates from Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, Kabardia, the Mountain Republic, Dagestan, as well as Turkey and Iran gathered to discuss the specific methods and ways of approaching women of the East. So here I would perhaps point out the role of the Genodzel experience, right, which was a great inspiration for the international movement, specifically in work among the women of the East, right? So the Genodzel already had some experience by the time, right? And its policy at this time in the early 20s was characterized by flexibility and sensitivity towards the conditions of life and cultural contexts that women in the East had to face. And it relied a lot on grassroots initiatives of these women, right? So, for example, the Genodzel adopted women-only organizational principle in eastern regions, right, in Soviet Central Asia and other eastern republics. So women would be organized in women-only workshops. They would have classes only for women, libraries, and at the same time, some kind of infrastructure would be put in place to take care of children, for instance, right, while women were engaged in those activities. So I think the United Front perspective was quite important, especially for this work among the women of the East, and indeed brought together representatives of different social groups and classes. All right, so that's the last but one item of the book, I believe. And the last, yes, and the last one which we have is called Communist Women's Movement Around the World. And this section includes reports from the Kommunistische Frauen Internationale on the work in 1921 to 22 in Germany, France, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, and Dutch East Indies. And I will perhaps stop here and let you read those reports for yourselves. And I think Mike has said a lot of important things about the relevance of the movement today, mostly in their theoretical conceptualizations of women's emancipation, but also revolution. I would just point out to three more kind of practical things that I find particularly relevant. And if you look at the campaigns that women's rights fighters and feminists are leading today, they resonate a lot with what revolutionary women have formulated more than 100 years ago, right? So, I guess the first most important aspect is the fact of linking women's emancipation and socialist transformation. And as to more specific aspects, I would say transformation of household duties and childcare related duties into social industry is something which is still quite relevant today. As a mother, I can definitely tell you that daycares are still not so easy to get in many places around the world. If they exist at all. Another point I personally find very important and relevant today is the protection of motherhood, right? Social aid to mothers and children, and at the same time, the freedom of choice in reproductive rights, which once again, all those questions are still being discussed, are still being fought for. So I think I will, yes. And of course, with all the international developments these days, anti-imperialist and anti-colonial fight remain as relevant as ever, and women's participation in them remain as important. So I will stop here, and I thank you very much for listening to us.